Hi, this is PodSafe the UK.
I'm Nish Kumar.
And I'm Coco Card.
This week, Parliament gets a Chinese burn.
Why are politicians turning their backs on the waspy women?
And what has Kim Jong-un got against Alan Titchmarsh's trousers?
Plus, our special guest is the spoken word artist and activist, George the Poet.
Hi, Coco.
Hi, Nish. How are you?
Good. How was your week?
It's been good. You know, so I'm going on holiday next week.
Oh, fantastic.
Oh, yes.
Where are you going?
I'm sort of...
Or would you prefer to not say?
I kind of don't want to tell you.
Is it North Korea?
No! I'm just going on a very nice beach holiday to Ayia Napa.
You're going to Ayia Napa?
That's why I didn't want to tell
what,
you.
The site of 90s raves?
90s UK garage, all right? It never dies. But I'm actually... This is why I didn't want to tell you, because I knew you were going to jump to the conclusion that I'm going to be going and listening to, like, DJ like an MC Nee, but yeah. I'm not. It's just genuinely a beach trip.
Right,
it's very beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people always say that Ibiza, the bit that isn't sort of sweaty clubs and rooms where the walls have STDs, is apparently like a very nice, soothing and peaceful place.
It's very, you know, blessed in the Balearics, right? So anyway, so that's where I'm going. So all of this week, I've been trying to, because you know when you go on holiday, you have to do the work that you would normally do first. Does
yeah,
that make
right.
sense?
Yeah,
so I've
yeah.
been kind of stressed out doing double
yeah, the
time
week,
work.
The week before the holiday is the worst possible week.
It's really weird with that. Like, I feel someone should address this. That needs, as a system, needs to be fixed. Because if before you go on holiday, you just have to do everything you did on holiday. Is it a holiday?
Yeah. Well, I found a solution to that.
What's that?
Yeah, never go on holiday.
Okay. Great solution. Anyway, what have you been up to?
I have had an unusually show business week for me.
Oh.
On Friday, I went to watch The Young Fathers at the Royal Albert Hall.
Yes.
For the Teenage Cancer Trust, who are an incredible charity. And for, I think, over 20 years, they've done a series of fundraising gigs at the Royal Albert Hall.
I know. I went to go see Franz Ferdinand and a teenager.
Really?
It's really dating me now, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, really?
What was it? What year was that? 2004? Maybe 5? Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
I recall it. They're good gigs.
And so that was great. And then on Monday, I went to the premiere of Monkey Man.
Okay.
Which is Dev Patel's movie that he has co-written, directed and stars in, and is produced by Jordan Peele of Get Out fame. And let me tell you, it was so much fun. It is incredibly violent.
Yeah.
It also has a very strong subtext that is pretty critical of India's current ruling government. So for me, ideal.
Right.
Strong political subtext, hyper-violent action movie. it's absolutely ideal. The only thing that's not ideal is, you know, as a, you know, Asian male working in the media, Dev is really making us all look bad.
I could see Dev having a bit of a Bruce Lee flex, actually.
He's been doing taekwondo since he was a kid.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
He's hench. He's, by all accounts, very nice. He's good looking. He took his mum to the Oscars.
Oh.
He dedicated this film in the introduction to his grandfather, who was like, and this is all about like the stories of Hanuman you used to tell me when you were growing up. And I have to say, I was not the only South Asian man in the audience just going, you're making us all look bad.
Yeah.
You know what, Dev? Suck it.
You know, you had that moment where you're like, I'm glad you exist, but how do we contain you? How do we lock you away?
I'm culturally thrilled by your impact. Personally, I'm furious about how bad you're making the rest of us look.
Okay, well, I mean, again, as usual, you outshine me with your high end. The last film I watched was The Beekeeper. I finally watched it.
You watched The Beekeeper?
It's very good. I mean, what is good? But it's, you know, good.
Did you enjoy the bit where he says to be or not to be?
Yeah, I very much did.
The House of Commons has gone into recess over Easter, and you have to wonder how many Conservative MPs will come back after the 20-day break, because currently they are dropping like flies. The Education Minister, Robert Halfen, has cleared out his desk. He's the latest Conservative to quit his ministerial post and announced that he'll be leaving Parliament at the next election. And he'll be joined by Armed Forces Minister James Heapy, who's also resigned from his post. All of which meant that Rishi Sunak had to do a quick last-minute mini-reshuffle, and most notably promoting backbench Red Wall blowhard Jonathan Gullis into Lee Anderson's old role of deputy party chairman, although I think we can all agree that unofficially his role is basically owning the libs by talking shit. One positive note for the beleaguered Sunak is that neither Halfen nor Heapy seem to be leaving in a huff. Both have written resignation letters that were incredibly loyal, They've not tried to leave by causing a problem, unlike the aforementioned Lee Anderson.
So a much more damaging story for the Tories is the resignation this week of their disgraced MP and gambling shill, Scott Benton. He jumped before he could be pushed. He was facing a vote by his constituents on whether to remove him after he was banned from the Commons following a lobbying scandal.
Benton was filmed secretly telling undercover reporters who were posing as gambling industry investors that he could lobby ministers for them. He was also recorded offering to table parliamentary questions and leak a confidential policy paper for up to £4,000 a month. The by-election in Blackpool South, which is one of the most deprived areas in England, will take place on the 2nd of May when voters in England and Wales go to the polls for local and mayoral elections, in which it's predicted that the Conservatives could lose up to 500 seats. And as for Scott Benton, what's the betting that he lands a cushy job at a gambling company?
So let's turn our attention to the plight of what's known as the WASPI women. So that stands for Women Against State Pension Inequality. These are a group of 60 plus women who are expecting by now to be putting their feet up on a state pension. For years, the pensionable age for women was 60 and for men 65. Then in 1995, the Conservative government decided it should be the same for both. It was meant to be a phased transition, but then the coalition government decided to speed it up. Many thousands of women said they had no idea they had to wait longer to receive their state pension, and they've suffered financial and emotional distress as a result. So a report by the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman, who spent 5 years examining the issue, recommended that the women should receive an apology and payouts of between £1,000 and £2,950. However, the Ombudsman can't compel the government to pay compensation and said that DWP had clearly indicated that it would, quote, refuse to comply, which was, quote, unacceptable. This week, the Work and Pensions Secretary Mel Stride told the Commons that the report would be properly considered, and Labour, while calling on him to act quickly, also failed to say what they would do about compensation. Listen, I think this is a massive story that doesn't get enough attention. I think we should all be seriously outraged about it. I feel like it's got post office scandal, ITV drama vibes about it. Like, I honestly think you could adapt it for TV and really hit home to people how awful this is.
Yeah, that's right. And because as unfortunately with the post office scandal, lots of people have died without receiving any compensation, right? There's the figure that I've read that's 270,000 of these women affected by the pension age change have died without receiving any compensation.
Right. And I keep wondering, like, why is it not getting so much attention? And I wonder, and I don't know what you think about it, but I feel like us as millennials can be possibly apathetic towards these plights of an older generation. You know, the boomers were told, get everything. But, you know, of the boomers, there were working class boomers, you know, and a lot of the women impacted by this would have been working class women who were working in factories, working on shop floors, working as nurses, working, you know, it's the 70s, do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't exactly a time of the high-flying woman. You know, they can't do those jobs now at 66, 68 and upwards. And they shouldn't have to. They were given a promise and that those promises should be kept. And also, if they break the promises to them, then they'll break them to us, right?
Yeah, I mean, currently it feels like our generation's plan for pensions is just to let the climate crisis engulf us. Like that, it does slightly seem like that.
Fiery death, that's your pension
plan. Yeah, we're all just going to burn anyway. Yeah, so okay. We may as well spend our money while we can. But what I would say is, the thing that's confusing to me about this story, why are the Conservative Party not more interested in pursuing this policy? And have they just fully given up? This is a policy that affects older people. They're certainly not making inroads in younger generations. We talked a few times about how, you know, the median age for the population turning towards Conservative votes is rising year by year. Mm-hmm. You know, as outcomes change for generations, there's little for people to conserve, so they're not turning to the Conservative Party is a kind of simplistic way of looking at it. But these are older people. These are supposed to be their voters.
I know, but
I don't understand. Yeah, is the Tory Party on some sort of, is this like a springtime for Hitler situation? Are they deliberately trying to tank their own party?
But it's not just the Tories, is it? I mean, Labour aren't coming out better on this, because the fact of the matter is it all costs a ton of money to give these women compensation.
It's certainly a story that I'm glad you've brought to the attention of the listeners, because I do think it's not receiving enough attention.
So let's turn our attention to a major diplomatic row brewing in the Far East.
Now, I'm going to take a swing at this and assume you're talking about China and not the diplomatic row that's brewing over North Korea censoring Alan Titchmarsh's trousers.
Well, he, you know, he writes raunchy novels.
Does he really?
Yeah, he does.
Wait, I didn't know he wrote. He writes erotic.
Yeah, he writes erotic literature.
For listeners who are not from the United Kingdom or not over 35 years old, we should clarify: Alan Titchmarsh, very inoffensive, well-liked British broadcaster, specialising in programmes about gardening. But North Korea's state television channel have censored an episode of one of the BBC gardening programmes. It's Alan Titchmarsh's Garden Secrets, which, if I'm honest, does sound like the name of a porn movie.
Thank you!
A 2010 episode aired on North Korean state television, but they have blurred out his trousers. Now, there's a lot of things to unpack here. We'll try and do it briefly because it's clearly not the important news story of the week in regards to a diplomatic row with a country in the Far East. But what I would say is that, A, North Korea state TV shows Alan Titchmarsh programs from 2010.
It's universal, babe.
I mean, that is a residual check I don't think Titchmarsh could have been anticipating. But the reason that they said that they've censored it is they censor jeans because they're a symbol of Western imperialism. What I would say is I have seen still photographs of the censored jeans, and it looks like Titchmarsh has got a raging boner.
See, this I knew, this is...
There's no way to talk about it other than that. It looks like not only does Titchmarsh have a... Because they've only really blurred out his
the crotch
sort of
area.
Pelvis.
Well, I mean, in fairness, when I first saw the image, I didn't actually know the story and I thought it was an erotica thing. You know, yeah. The jeans is synonymous with male erotica. George Michael's Faith video.
The Andy Warhol cover for Rolling Stone's Sticky Fingers.
Yes, exactly. So I thought, well, he does write erotica. So
well, look.
So maybe he's thirsty Alan Titchmarsh. We don't know.
I would say, you know, if I was Alan Titchmarsh, I wouldn't dispel any of these rumours because somehow North Korean state TV has made it look like he's packing serious heat. That is some... an impressive piece of gardening equipment. But before we go down a road that is only going to be edited out of the final broadcast, Coco, please move on to the actual significant story of the week.
Look, a major diplomatic row has broken out between the UK and China after Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden accused China of being behind malicious cyber campaigns that would be against MPs and the Electoral Commission.
I can confirm today that Chinese state-affiliated actors were responsible for two malicious cyber campaigns targeting both our democratic institutions and parliamentarians. First, the compromise of the United Kingdom Electoral Commission between 2021 and 2022, which was announced last summer. And second, attempted reconnaissance activity against UK parliamentary accounts in a separate campaign in 2021.
Rishi Sunak is reportedly facing anger from some MPs over what they have characterised as a feeble response from the Prime Minister. That's after the government announced sanctions against two hackers and a small firm in Wuhan. A lot of stuff going on in Wuhan.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
I really am surprised that we're back talking about Wuhan again.
The most high-profile figure to be targeted by the Chinese is the former Conservative leader, Sir Ian Duncan Smith, who's a member of the Interparliamentary Alliance on China, which scrutinises and often criticises the activities of Beijing. He likened the government's announcement of sanctions to an elephant giving birth to a mouse. The Chinese embassy in the UK says the allegations are completely unfounded and amount to malicious slander. Nish, this is a far cry from the days. Do you remember those days when David Cameron would have a pint with President Xi Jinping?
Yeah, that's right. Cameron visited Beijing when he was Prime Minister in 2013 and called it the start of a golden era between the two countries and said that the UK would be the country's strongest advocate in the West. Then in 2015, he really rolled out the carpet for Xi Jinping, took him for a pint at a pub in Chequers. And he also posed for a selfie with Sergio Aguero when the two men visited Manchester City's training ground. Then after leaving number 10, and this is where we get into somewhat sticky terrain, okay? Because obviously this is a serious diplomatic row that's brewing, and the given that David Cameron has made an unfathomable, to many of us, return to politics as foreign secretary, it is an issue that David Cameron, after his time in Number 10, continued to engage with Chinese interests, leading a $1 billion UK-China investment fund for which he visited Beijing and had dinner with Xi in 2018. He also took on a paid role supporting a major port project in Sri Lanka, which is backed by huge Chinese state investment. Now, to be clear, Cameron's spokesperson has said that he has not engaged in any way with China or any Chinese company in regard specifically to his appearances on behalf of the Colombo project. But, I imagine there is some concern here. And also, there is a problem with us trying to talk tough on China. The cabinet minister, Gillian Keegan, basically admitted as such when she said that we get a lot of our imports from China. So, look, there is an issue with talking tough on a country so much of whose money is pouring into Britain. And it is worth asking the questions of David Cameron about his conduct. There is starting to be the sense that David Cameron basically left Number 10 with an assumption that he would not return to politics. That's my personal view on this situation.
Yeah.
It feels like everything that Cameron's done, not just on this issue, but if we look at the sort of scandal around his involvement in Greensill, there is a sense to me that David Cameron left politics and thought, well, I'm never going back there again. He was flipping everyone the middle finger on his way out. And he was basically now thinking, well, I'll basically cash in on my ministerial influence. Now he's returned to politics. That period of time where he was out in the political wilderness, but in the financial dumping ground of just huge stacks of money into his account, there are serious questions for Foreign Secretary David Cameron. And there are also serious questions over Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's judgment in bringing Cameron back into frontline politics.
Our special guest this week is George Mpanga, better known as the spoken word artist, poet, podcaster, rapper, author, activist, George the Poet. Have I missed anything?
I don't know.
Have you thought about taking up welding? let's just keep adding
jobs. It's on the to-do list. It's on the to-do list. But thank you very much for having me, guys.
Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for being here. You're about to publish a new book, which is a sort of memoir. It's called Track Record, Me, Music and the War on Blackness. And it's a book that you, I can't remember the exact phrases, you set out to write an autobiography.
Yeah.
And then got, I'd say, very sidetracked.
Yeah. You could say sidetracked. I guess I became very immersed in the context of my story. And the context is a global one. You know, I think we can all look at our stories, our journeys, those of our forebearers, in their international historical context. And I think that's something that we should try and do a bit more.
I mean, the context of your background is fascinating in so many ways. Your grandmother was actually a Ugandan politician.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Yeah. Joyce Mpanga. She was the first Minister for Women's Affairs in Uganda in the 86 government.
That's absolutely incredible. And
Bless
then
us all.
You actually, I mean, you contemplated going into politics at one stage.
Can you imagine? I did.
I don't know, George. I mean, you seem clean and articulate, and that would put you above, I would say, 99% of the Conservative Party right now. Have you seen a photo of Jonathan Gullis? Man looks like he woke up in a hedge.
Yeah, I mean, The state of our politicians isn't anything to judge ourselves by. But I was interested in potentially trying to enter parliament in some way. I didn't know what to make of how I would be positioned. And a lot of this book is me finally articulating things that I knew would be real sticking points if I was to pursue a political career.
I mean, you occupy a really interesting position, I think, that reflects us as well. You know, we are from like the arts and culture space. You know, this idea that politics doesn't just happen in Westminster. Politics happens in everyday life, like how you live, the day-to-day of your life, what you eat, how much you can afford, the bins being taken out. That's politics. And so when you feel that politics is on the street and politics is in culture, what use is there for politics of Westminster? And I wondered, because you said earlier you thought about going into politics and now you're, what is your relationship to Westminster now? How do you feel about it?
I feel very alienated from Westminster, as I think many, if not most of us do. the election of George Galloway was interesting. I'm still trying to figure out what to make of it. I noticed that it caused a shift within me to think, oh, maybe this thing, if that was to happen across the country and people were to align with their whoever they felt most reflected what was most important to them as whole constituencies, maybe. But I feel deeply cynical towards Westminster at this time. I've seen so much disingenuous lip service paid to values, principles and morals that they don't adhere to time and time again. I was doing my A-levels, I think, when the... Do you remember the expenses scandal?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I was doing politics A-level when the expenses scandal broke. And I remember being like, these people are not nice.
Yeah.
They're not nice people. And I just feel like everything I've seen since then is more of that. So maybe, you know, I'm open to the idea that there might be a generational change, since I do believe millennials and Gen Z are highly skeptical of these institutions. But yeah, it wouldn't be my first port of call.
And also, if George Galloway is the best we can muster for representation, then we're fucked.
It's crazy out here. It's crazy. Yeah.
Do you vote? Sorry, I was just curious. When you were talking there, I was like, I was just curious.
I haven't voted in a while.
Right.
Haven't voted in a while. I don't know what I'm going to do next election. I mean, yeah.
Do you spoil or do you not show?
Do I spoil or not show?
Spoil your ballot paper.
Oh, no. I just stay away. If
But that's, I would say that's probably a pretty damning indictment of the state of our politics.
Well,
right?
If
someone is politically engaged as you,
feels
that they can't affect any change even by voting.
And for years, I've been approached by organisations that want me to promote the vote.
Yeah.
And I've just been like, this doesn't feel serious. This doesn't feel real. That's a real, it's a growing problem in my life. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Mm. Well, you're going to have to figure it out soon, because it's coming up really fast. Right.
I mean, yeah, because I would always say, like, because I've also done similar things, like to get out, especially people of colour to go and vote, because I still always, there's still a part of me that believes like we have to sort of, the engagement is still the best way of like tilting policy towards making things that actually have relevance to our lives. You know, I think I think you get trapped in a situation where if the only people that vote are old white people, which statistically, unfortunately, is the only people that vote, all of the party's manifestos that come back are just policies aimed at old white people.
Yeah, that's one way of conceptualizing our situation. Where I get stuck is obviously what is on offer. Obviously, I don't see much divergence. I don't see much variation. And the parameters of debate nowadays just seem to be narrowing and narrowing. And I do think it's something to just keep us a little busy, you know, make us feel like we are part of the political process, when there's a much deeper process of, I think, political sensitization, expanding the conversation. That's the end of politics that I'm on. At one point there was something meaningful in saying that I'm going to vote Labour. But now, you know, Labour as opposed to the Tories, we spent the last however many years under Tory rule. When I was a kid, it felt like there was some kind of polls and there was some kind of difference. Now, I do not believe that is on the table. I don't know what you guys think. Do you think there's any
At the moment,
wiggle room?
It's very hard to know what Labour stands for, because the entire tactic seems to be say nothing, hope for a Tory implosion.
But do you believe that there is an identity to the Labour Party at this point?
I mean, I'm really conflicted. Like you, you know, I grew up in like council housing, like grew up in the ends. And, you know, I remember the Labour years being a bit better for my family and my community. I remember that, like 97 to, what was it,
2010.
Mm-hmm. I remember that being improved. And so I still have a little bit of that in me saying like, okay, it's not far enough. It doesn't go where I want it to go, but it is better. And can I not help participate in like lifting the just the weight on that community just a little bit more. And I'm really conflicted by that. Other times I feel like I'm being bribed because the other guys are so bad that I'm being bribed into it. And then other times I feel genuinely quite inspired where I'm like, the Labour Party is not just the leadership, it's the movement, it's the trade unions, it's the activists, and that's got a really long legacy.
And you still believe that it's all of those things?
I don't know, but those are my conflicting thoughts. And it's weird, isn't it? You have all of them at once.
Yeah.
And I understand is what I'm saying. I get it. I get why people say, this situation is not one I want to participate in. I'm sort of not very clear. I think you know where you are.
I mean, there's also part of me that's just, I think just mechanically the ruling party has to be removed at the moment, because I think just it's not, we don't have a functional government at the minute. If you look at actual policy making, it isn't just a question of, I disagree with the policies that they're producing. They are unable to make policy because all it is it's a kind of weekly psychodrama, and Sunak's position is essentially untenable. You know, he knows that he wasn't wanted by the membership of his own party, so he spends all of his time trying to appeal to them. That means that he doesn't actually, you know, what policy achievements can they point to? Because they are politically unable to make it. Because of you know, we're just at the end of it's basically like the Conservative Party in the mid-90s. We're just at the end of a cycle of government. So my main overriding feeling at the moment is that they just need to go.
But I mean, we're all talking about the Labour Party here, but actually there are other options.
I was about to ask about that.
Yeah, so, I mean, lying if I wouldn't say I am tempted by the Greens.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, hello. Maybe I can answer that call. Do you know what I mean?
Most definitely. I do think the Greens are probably going to make some significant gains in the next election. And I'm, for the first time in my life, taking them seriously. I will never forgive Labour for their support for this genocide. It's just is what it is.
Either they don't know or they don't care. But I really, one way or another, the Labour leadership, I don't think has properly calculated the impact the rhetoric around Gaza is having on its own vote. And I think aside from the moral imperative, which is obviously the most important thing, I don't think that they've realised electorally the damage that it's doing them.
You think
with their own base? Well, I mean, I don't know. Well, maybe they don't realise, maybe they don't care. I can't definitively answer that way or another. Yeah, but either way, it seems astonishingly self-defeating.
But if not Westminster, what... I mean, this is something you talk about in the book. Like, how do you make political change? What can it look like?
I think the one thing that we don't have is a grassroots culture of political education. So most of us are thrown into the political space when we're old enough to vote, and we take our cues from media. And many of us just never get the time to really deep dive into where our political culture evolved from, why it is that the Labour years felt so different from, you know, today, why it is that even Middle East policy within the Tory party, within the Republican party, was so different, you know, or not so different, but had significant differences from the 80s to now. These are things that we really need to wrestle with over our lifetimes, not just when it's an election cycle. And I think that is the missing piece in our democracy, long-term political education. At the start of my journey, I was just trying to generate ideas for the creative milieu that I came from, the social milieu that I came from. You know, I was from the working class Black community, the artist community of a certain generation. We came up under the first wave of grime, and I saw guys develop so many talents and opportunities and cultural touch points. I just saw Mo the Comedian on Jimmy Fallon the other night, and he was very much part of that generation. He was part of my
come up. Yeah, I don't think people realise that. Like, he's very sort of that kind of,
yeah,
you know.
He gave me the name George the Poet. He didn't realise it.
Did he really?
He didn't, yeah. I didn't really have a stage name, and he was just introducing me like George the Poet.
Yeah.
Other people kind of contributed some ideas as well, so I won't put it all on him, but like, I remember him being there. But ultimately, I was like, look, we generate all of this cultural activity. How can it translate into a way of organizing our community? And again, you get to organizing the community. These are the answers to the questions that you're asking, Coco. Like, ultimately, this is where we will be able to make our decisions about the direction of our society at a community level with some level of coordination across the country. And it happens. It happens in various ways. There's a reason why Mulder Comedians on Jimmy Fallon. Of course, primarily his hard work got him there. But in a broader sense, our collaboration, our cultural, artistic space got him there, got me here, allowed British rap to become a best-selling genre, which was unheard of when we were growing up. So what more could we achieve?
Where do you stand on the idea that artists have like an obligation to engage politically with the circumstances in which they're making art?
Yeah, that's not a mainstream idea right now. It's not a very popular angle. I think it comes from the breakdown of our responsibility to each other. I think because we can no longer assume that we have a responsibility, a collective responsibility to society, because we are made to feel so individualized and we're propagandized in these ways from all sorts of angles, it's very difficult to convince most people that artists who come up in this context should also be speaking to our political reality.
What if they are really down there?
Yeah, but this is the thing. Again, going back to political education.
Yeah.
Most of us are unable to really comment. Most of us are made useless, made redundant to the political process by an education system that doesn't require us to engage with it. So, you know, there are no short answers to the way out. This is why when you ask me what I think should happen, it is a pivot towards long-term grassroots political engagement and just once and for all abandoning this culture of it being cool to stay aloof and somehow promote what I'm promoting to you is success without responsibility. That has to die.
Success without responsibility. I mean, that's a great phrase. Well, you're a writer. I should be surprised that you could turn a phrase, but that it's a great, yeah, success without responsibility. I mean, is a fascinating way of looking at it.
It is mad. Like, I mean, when I first started doing journalism about arts and culture, like that tension about like, oh, you know, why have they got to talk politics about it? Yeah. It's annoying or what? And actually now there's a sense of like, it's gone so far that they're only doing it for clout. And that's really an impossible thing to deal with. Like we're, you know, our faith in each other is so poor, but then perhaps there is some truth in it.
There are those, but ultimately the proof is in the pudding, right? To what extent are we really able to get to the root of what is disturbing us as a society? You can pose and you can pretend for a while, but ultimately it will be the people to say whether or not you have raised their consciousness, whether or not you really are helping them practically deal with the reality of their situation. I'm aware that there are, you know, clout chasers in this, but I do think given enough time, the truth will reveal itself about who's committed.
So, okay, but being in the public eye, and you know this firsthand, people are very unforgiving. You know, you're growing you're developing as a person in the public. You're not fully formed by the time you become a creative star, right?
Well, and also you've been in the public eye since you were, a child, basically.
Really young. Yeah. So, and people are very unforgiving. Like, you know, there must have been moments where you look back where you've done stuff, that you've said stuff, where you've participated in things and been like, that doesn't really match who I am now. But hey, you know what? I was learning, but people won't forgive.
Right.
So one, what are your thoughts on that sort of level of forgiveness? Do you think that actually we do need to better accept our cultural leaders, makers as they grow? But and what does that mean for the discourse? Doesn't that mean we dumb down our dialogue? What about standards? Mm. And also, can you tell us about a time that you were human?
I actually mentioned this in the book. There was an incident about a few years ago now when I did an interview. The interview was about prison education. I'd been doing some work in the prison education space. And in the interview, what I meant to say, I think what I did say was, when you find someone in prison, there is a unique space that you can find them in, where you can actually provide opportunities for some real education. It's just been my thing for a while.
It was an observer interview, and because I didn't know about it until I read the book, but yeah, it's an observer interview, and right. you're talking about specific work that you've done with people who are incarcerated, and giving your experience of detailing that.
What I didn't realize is that it would kind of come across as if I am advocating for the carceral system in general, and many people took it like that online, and you know, the conversation just got very crazy very quickly, and there was a mix of people that had critiques that I needed to hear with regards to how I present myself in media and how I present my arguments and how it is then framed. I needed to hear some of that stuff, but then there were people that were doing a lot, you know, like you said, the very unforgiving, very nasty side of social media, and it kind of all got mixed up, and I responded in a human way. I was kind of dealing with people one-on-one. The shut up you prick kind of approach with some people, but I was trying to be smarter than that, and it was just kind of impossible because that was a time where I feel like I should have just listened and you know, maybe made a statement to clarify what I believe and left it there. But you know, you get dragged in, they drag you in and they beat you.
Yeah, I'm sure you know in Godfather 3. Every time you think you're out, they pull you back in.
That happened to me. And I learned from that experience. I used the word woke in a way that was now that is now associated heavily with the right wing.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't read the room at the time. I didn't realize at the time, the word woke, unfortunately, had been appropriated away from its origins in, I believe, the Black American community.
Yeah.
And it was being used as a parody for anyone that believes in anything progressive. And I said something like, this is the problem with woke culture, when I was talking about performativity.
Yeah.
Right, I see. Okay,
right. So there's all sorts of conversations happening, but it's just hard. There's levels to this. But yeah, it's hard to navigate that. And part of that is just, you know, part and parcel of being a public figure, as I'm sure you guys will know.
It's hard when it's your team. Like, I think because if, like, I assume if a bunch of, I assume you're a similar person to me, there's certain people that give you grief where you go, yeah, good.
Yeah.
I'd be doing something profoundly wrong if you liked me.
Yeah, 100%.
But when it's, and you know, I've had various experiences of this in the past where it's people you broadly agree with, you're like, there's a defensiveness, I think, where you go, well, hang on. I'm one of the good guys.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And that first impulse of I'm a good guy is often, I think, what actually makes things worse. But it's a totally human thing. It's a totally human thing for the first thing you think to be, but I'm one of the good guys.
Very true.
But if you don't, I think if you don't push against that impulse, you just become more and more defensive, and then you know, and then you learn anything. That's my experience of these things. Yeah.
And then
first
you start
impulse.
Arguing from a place of ego rather than principle.
And we're all using words, being like, "Well, actually, I don't think that's very feminist." But really, you just want to say, "Shut up, you prick."
Yeah, that's what you really mean.
Just say, "Shut up, you prick."
But I'm really glad we're talking about this because I feel like we haven't touched on this really on the podcast. It's just whenever I hear people, conservative people, talking about, oh, the cozy consensus on the left, I'm like, what left-wing people do you know?
Yeah.
It's hard to get five left-wing people to agree on where to eat on a Friday.
Anything but.
I also really value that because I think actually out of those constructive arguments, you can actually either learn something and change your perspective or actually understand and reinforce something you believe in. It's a really important part of moving your thinking along.
That's a very good point.
But it's hard when we have the shut up you prick. I think the shut up you prick factor is what, if we're going to have grown up progressive conversations, we have to have disagreements. Like we have to, but we have to take the shut up, you prick, out of it.
But the shut up, you prick is human, right?
And you've got such academic authority that this already feels like an actual piece of... Yeah. Of course, George the Poet's shut up, you prick principle.
Yeah. Let's get into the shut up, you prick. No, I think if you look at how most of us were using social media 15 years ago, it's different from how we're using it today. And in 15 years' time, it will be different. We look at things that we did 15 years ago and we cringe.
Yeah.
they're always cringeworthy. We all have cringeworthy stuff that we did on social media. So a lot of what is happening is us moving through this new media space and learning what works and what doesn't. And as much as it is easy to get into a shut up you prick space, we on the left ultimately want progress. So we're going to have to figure it out.
Is that a big part of why writing a book is so important to you? Because it means you can, it's a brilliant book. And part of the reason that I think it's so good is that the weaving of the personal and the political is kind of seamless. There's no gap between the personal stories that you're trying to share with us mm-hmm. and the political ideas that you're trying to advance.
Thank you.
On that note, guys, I have to say, thank you so much, George the Poet, for your time. And his new book is a searing read. It pulls no punches, I think it's fair to say. And yeah, it's a beautiful summary of all your thoughts and your lyricism.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for
and
having
it's
me.
It's out.
It's out on April 25th.
Great. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, George. If you're currently tuning into this episode on Google Play, listen up.
Starting next week, the Google Play app will no longer be in use. Make sure to save PodSave the UK on your next favourite podcast platform so you never miss an episode.
New episodes out on Thursday.
Nish, you're back on familiar territory, giving a beat down to our villain of the week. So who have you gone for?
I've gone for Conservative Party headquarters for their absolutely unfathomable attack ad on London Mayor Sadiq Khan in support of the party's candidate for London Mayor, who is called Susan Hall, a name that I think we can all agree none of us know. We live in London. We have very little idea of who she is. But a quick Google reveals that she's called Susan Hall and she's on social media expressed her support for Donald Trump. So that's exciting. That's exciting for the City of London. The clip, which was posted on social media by the Conservative Party, portrays London as a city sort of gripped by a fear of crime with people cowering indoors too afraid to leave the house. It had to be taken down and re-edited almost immediately because it used footage of a stampede in a New York City subway station to depict panic in London.
Gripped by the tendrils of rising crime, London citizens stay inside. The streets are quiet. Quieter at night now than they used to be. A 54% increase in knife crime since the Labour mayor seized power has the metropolis teetering on the brink of chaos. And in the chaos, people seek a desperate reprieve, egged on by the Labour mayor who wants to decriminalize the use of illegal drugs.
Yeah, so the footage of that stampede was from New York's Penn Station following false reports of gunfire in 2017. I mean, there's a lot to talk about in this video. First and foremost, why is the narrator American? What? And also, what part of America is that person from?
Gotham.
I am from America. I am definitely not a British man doing an American accent. The narrator warns of squads of ULEZ enforcers. This is a direct quote. I feel like I'm drunk. It's squads of ULEZ enforcers dressed in black, faces covered with masks, terrorizing communities at the beck and call of their Labour mayor master, who has implemented a tax on driving, forcing people to stay inside or go underground. Does that mean use the tube? Or is this person implying that the ULEZ tax has forced people in London to become Ninja Turtles? It also says, gripped by the tendrils of rising crime, London citizens stay inside. The streets are quiet. The streets are quiet because no one can afford their mortgages because of the Conservative Prime Minister who lasted less time than a fucking vegetable. The video also refers to Sadiq Khan as seizing power rather than being lawfully elected twice. Susan Hall, the candidate who we all think is a real person, has actually distanced herself from the video, saying that she hadn't seen it and it had nothing to do with her campaign team. It was created by the Conservative Party headquarters. Responding to the video's claim that crime in the capital had risen during his time in office, Sadiq Khan said, because of government cuts over the last 14 years, we've lost thousands of police officers. The mayor also added that crime had fallen in a number of categories, including homicides, gun crime and burglary, since he first took office in 2016. So the video is horseshit from beginning to end. It's also really badly made. I showed it to a friend of mine yesterday
and he thought that I was playing a prank on him and that it was a sketch that had been made. It's so abysmally put together. I truly, my 17-year-old cousin could have done a better job given 25 minutes and access to iMovie. It's absolute horseshit. I just, at a certain point, is it time for the Conservative Party to just be wound up and we all just send it off, give it a Viking funeral and just wind it up? And small C Conservative people in this country, maybe just start a new political party. Maybe just start from the ground up. Because based on this video, I'm afraid this thing is now just rotten to the core.
Never forget that Susan Hall said she got robbed, but she didn't. She dropped her wallet and someone gave it back. Do you remember that? Do you remember that whole thing?
I don't know who Susan Hall is, and I'm not convinced she exists. Okay. That's my conspiracy theory for the week. I don't think Susan Hall exists.
Susan Hall is AI.
I think Susan Hall is AI. I think they've hired an actress. All I will say is, if you think that this is us being irresponsible broadcasters spreading half-baked conspiracy theories based largely on falsehoods, I would say you should expend your energy being angry on the Conservative Party for making this fucking ad this week. Coco, who's your hero of the week?
So this week, I'm going to talk about a hugely brave and inspiring man who sadly passed away this week. It's Richard Taylor. So he's the father of Damilola Taylor. We're about the same age, Nish. So you will remember the news stories about Damilola. He was just 10 years old when he was stabbed and left to die in a stairwell in Peckham in South London 24 years ago. It was horrific. And it just sent chills up the spine of every family. You know, Richard made it his life's work to tackle knife crime since then. He was particularly really moved by the stories of families with young children impacted by that. And he did amazing things. He was appointed as an anti-knife crime envoy by then Prime Minister Gordon Brown, and was later made an OBE for his services to reducing youth violence. He said he wanted his son to be remembered as a boy of hope and for his legacy to be a better life and opportunities for underprivileged young people. I mean, I've spoken in this section before about like the mothers who something happens to their children and they basically say, you know, my child could not exist in this world. The world wanted my child to change or be someone else. And so actually instead I will change the world. And I always thought that was really moving. And, you know, actually there's plenty of fathers as well. And Richard is one of those. So I just think his work is incredible. So the Damilola Taylor Trust runs a number of outreach programs, including internship schemes, educational courses and mentoring projects that will still continue. So his work will still go on. And Harriet Harman, I think, said it best, really. The former Labour minister and MP for Camberwell and Peckham paid tribute to Mr. Taylor on X, saying he never stopped fighting for other children to have the chances that his son never had.
It's an incredible man.
So get in touch with us by emailing psuk@reducelistening.co.uk. We love to hear your voices. So if you're feeling brave, send us a voice note on WhatsApp. Our number is 07514 644 572. And internationally, that's +44 7514 644 572.
Don't forget to follow @PodSaveTheUK on Instagram and Twitter. You can also find us on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. Also, drop us a review if you like, but only if it's positive. We literally couldn't give a shit about your negative reviews.
Very, very thin-skinned.
Pod Save the UK is a Reduced Listening production for Crooked Media.
Thanks to senior producer Musty Aziz.
Production support and video editing was by Nada Smiljanic and the music is by Vasilis Fotopoulos.
Thanks to our engineer, David Degahi.
The executive producers are Anishka Sharma, Dan Jackson and Madeline Herringer, with additional support from Ari Schwartz.
Remember to hit subscribe for new shows on Thursdays on Amazon, Spotify or Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.